Banquet feast continues, and our next speaker is Brother Jim Parkinson, and the topic that he has chosen to speak to us on and share his studies with us this afternoon is the Bible and modern science. Without further delay, Brother Jim.
Thank you, Brother Steve. Brethren at the San Gabriel Valley class in California also send their love to each and every one, and they would like to have been here. Now, perhaps next year, they'll find it a lot easier. Our subject for today came about in about 10 weeks ago. There were three articles or technical notes in the magazine Science, the May 26, 1995 issue. And they caught my attention, and thinking, this is rather timely. These are three articles that deal with DNA, one of the more recent sciences, particularly that deal on the origin of humans and animals. And so I thought perhaps it would be profitable to share that, but more than that, there's a pattern, it seems, in several different sciences. Now, a good many of these sciences, including paleogenetics and paleobiology, are primarily worked by people who have a stake in the evolution theory, if they'd like to keep their jobs. And that's a high stake. But instead of proving it, there are some things that seem to be real weaknesses in the theory. And these have been brought out in the last few decades, and in some cases, a few years, and in this case, 1995. So we're going to look at six branches of science in the time here. These will be cosmology, paleogenetics, paleobiology, historical linguistics, biblical archaeology, and papyrology. What was that? Papyrology is the study of ancient papyri. What are papyri? Papyri is the plural of papyrus. But we'll begin with cosmology. What does cosmology tell us? That's the study of the origins of the universe and the solar system and so forth. There have been a number of different types of theory over the years and the centuries, but the current theory is called the Big Bang. That from a point, there was a Big Bang at some time early at the beginning of the universe, and everything expanded out from there. Now, one theory is it expanded uniformly, or almost so. Another, that it was very non-uniform. Some streamers went out this way and some out that way. Still another theory that it went out in waves, and each one tries to explain things that we find in the universe. But there is one thing these theories all have in common, which is a denial of several of the previous theories. The Big Bang says there was a beginning. And that is what Genesis 1:1 says. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Most of the mysteries of cosmology remain unsolved. Cosmology includes things like the origin of the universe. Is the universe expanding or oscillating? Like, will it come back on itself and go crash like it went Big Bang in the first place? Or will it keep on expanding forever and ever? What is the origin of the solar system? The origin of the moon and so forth? In this entire century, only one of these questions has been answered to reach a consensus. That is, the conclusion now is that the moon came from a glancing blow of some kind of a small planet or planetoid, hunk of material, with the Earth, and that there was an exchange of materials in which the Earth got the heavier set of the materials. And that, therefore, this material that came back out again was sort of loosely connected to the Earth through gases, and as it rotated around, it caused the face of the moon to continue to face the Earth at all times. And it continues then to drift farther and farther away from the Earth, but very, very slowly. There are no other mysteries of cosmology that have a generally agreed upon answer at this point. And this one of the origin of the moon, then, would be classed as taking place at the end of Genesis 1:1, before verse 2. We'll go on now to paleogenetics, and that is where the DNA comes in. Paleo meaning old, perhaps back in the thought of stones and stone origins, the rocks that they're found in. Paleogenetics, then they dig out the DNA from the various fossils, whether it's human or whether it is animals. And one of these was published in Science magazine in 1994, volume 265, page 1229. The interest was that there are new dinosaur finds up in Montana, which have quite revolutionized the concept of dinosaurs. It appears that they did live in social communities. And I think Jurassic Park was markedly affected by the new discovery. The interest was to find out whether dinosaurs were the evolutionary parent to birds or amphibians, or possibly vice versa. It had to be one way or the other, supposedly. So by digging out the DNA from dinosaur bones, the idea is to compare this with the DNA of frogs or various birds to see which one it is closer to. The result was that it is not close to either one of them. Instead, what they dug out was closest to human beings. I think I've met a few human beings that might qualify, but we'll change that in time. One of the articles that, or short technical note, in the May 26th this year issue of Science, was sorely critical of this paper for two reasons. One is, it hadn't been confirmed that this DNA is closely related to humans and not to the other things. Of course, how can you confirm something that isn't published in the first place? And the second was, they probably should not have published if they didn't agree with the theory. The results must agree with the theory, or you simply don't publish. The other two articles in this magazine, May 26, are on page 1183-5 and 1141-2. And its origin goes back about 8 years, when some study was done on the mitochondrial DNA. That's a part of the DNA molecule that is passed only from female to female to female. And by noting the differences, the intent was to see how many different women there are in the ancestry of the human race. And the conclusion was just one. It was like an army attack from several people after that. That was not the right conclusion as far as some were concerned, including one of the professors at the University of Michigan. But nevertheless, subsequent studies continued to confirm that the human race is all descended from one common female, and some were not reluctant to call it Eve. But that still left the question of how many male ancestors were there, and that is what was published 10 weeks ago. The work was done on a section of the DNA chain close to what's called a zinc finger of the Y chromosome, and that's well worth forgetting. So just let's consider that it's a 729 member of the chain that was investigated, and they took 38 people from around the entire globe. These 38 men were intended to be representative as possible of the whole human race in geography, in racial features, and the idea was that if the human race diverged from a male ancestor a million years ago, then there would be approximately 19 1/2 changes in the chain during that period of time. And so the measurements were made, and the number of changes they actually found was zero. By the most reasonable assumption, which they acknowledge in the footnote, and perhaps that's not sufficiently emphasized by them, by the most reasonable, in fact only reasonable set of assumptions, that the human race continued to diverge after this time, there is a 95% probability that the common male ancestor of the human race was not more than 80,000 years ago, and is probably less than 27,000 years ago. Anywhere between 0 and 27,000 years ago. We don't think it is zero, do we? Well, Noah fits that pattern rather well. 4,500 years, well within the span. And then there was Genesis 3:20, and the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And then we have the common male ancestor, Noah. Not bad agreement, considering the people didn't want that conclusion. We look now to another field, paleobiology. We here speak of the theory of evolution, but really we can't. We must speak of the theories of evolution. There have been three of them thus far, all mutually inconsistent. We start with the theory of Charles Darwin, the Darwinian theory, which we might call variation theory. And his concept, I'll try to illustrate this. His concept is that each succeeding generation in the human race had progressively more variations, and we have a strain here, and then it comes to a stop, and we have another strain here that's a little higher, and it continues on a little longer. Here's a strain that, for some reason didn't quite make it, but keep going up, and this one did better than the others. And it seemed reasonable to many scientists of the time, but it had a problem. Somebody came across genetics, a fellow by the name of Gregor Mendel in Austria, and it was determined that genetics is fixed in the genes, and therefore you can't have a progressively wider variability potential in each generation, and a fellow who lost a foot didn't have children without a foot. So the characteristics were not drawn from every part of the body. They were fixed in the genes. Another serious problem was that over the years, in looking for these missing linkages here, the missing linkages were not found. So we have to make these lines dashed now. They're strictly a part of a person's philosophy if he says that it existed when you don't find any evidence of it. And so along came Hugo de Vries about the turn of the century, who discovered mutations of the genes. And at first this was thought to be the death knell of the theory of evolution. But clever fellows, these evolutionists, they said, maybe this is the mechanism by which evolution takes place. And the time during which these mutations takes place might be only 10,000 years out of a million, so the chances of finding these missing links is small. Not negligible, let's keep digging. But still, the reason we don't find them is because there are very few of them. Well, they kept right on digging and still not finding. That was among the problems. So the new theory of evolution, current in the last 20 years or so, we might refer to not as variation theory or mutation theory, but the third theory, a calamity theory, in which the idea is we don't observe evolution taking place, we can't see it happening in the lab, so it only happens when there's a great, terrific event that causes an enormous amount of stress in the population, a fantastic number of freaks, most of which haven't the slightest chance of surviving, but a few of them can survive. And this is why we dig up evidence that there was a fauna across the entire Earth, or animal kingdom across the entire Earth, and somehow it seems to have vanished and been replaced with an inferior fauna. And this is the way it happened. It expanded into a food-rich environment. There was no need of a survival of the fittest against one another. And this may be illustrated by saying that we have different species here, and then either at one time or another, let's make some of these coincident here, that we have sudden changes, and these things continue on. And this we may refer to, let's see, this one is number 1 and 2 down here in the lower portion. And this is evolution theory number 3, the calamity theory. And in this case, one of their leaders, Stephen Jay Gould, says that it is pusillanimous, let's use a better word, cowardly, to suggest that the first bird did not hatch directly from a reptilian egg. Now, if you were a researcher out in the field, how could you distinguish that from creation? The only difference with creation is you just simply erase these things that happened all in one generation. How could you distinguish between the calamity theory and creation theory unless you propose to find the first eggshell? It would appear at that point that the latest evolution theory, which is gaining the ground, is indistinguishable from creation theory. Therefore, a perfect counterfeit. However, the DNA studies that we've just gone through allow too little time for evolution. They acknowledge in the article that even if you multiply the times by a factor of 10, it is much too recent to account for any known theory of evolution at the present time. The Bible is really looking pretty good. Was it Genesis that changed? No, it's the evolution theory that has had to change in order to look like the Bible. How did Moses know that 3,500 years ago? Or did Moses know that 3,500 years ago? Or was there somebody who told him who was around at the time because he did the job? Now we come to historical linguistics. This is a study of ancient languages to see where they came from, how they got to be the way they are in this welter of 5,000 languages around the world. And I see our time is fleeting just a little bit, so I won't take as much time as I'd love to. But in Moscow, in the Soviet Disunion now, it was worked on in the 1960s to determine that several groups of languages had a common origin, Indo-European and Semito-Hamitic, which includes Hebrew, and there was Finno-Ugric, which includes the Finnish and Hungarian languages and the Samoyed languages in the north of Russia, the Altaic languages of Siberia, the Dravidian in South India, that's the black part of India, in the south, primarily southeast is the better preserved form in the Tamil language today, and also a little language south of the Caucasus Mountains in the Kartvelian region. In Genesis 10, it's called Tubal, from Kara Tubal, the rocks or mountains of Tubal. And this today accounts for about 60% of the world's population having a common origin in its languages. Since that time, some other Soviet scholars have worked on the Chinese languages to find that they are related to those in the North Caucasian Mountains, and also the so-called Nadini languages, the Navajo and Tlingit in the United States and Canada. I believe it's correct to say that the Navajo is just one language out of hundreds, but its speakers probably outnumber all of the other Indian tribes put together. So it's not small. Now we're up to 88% of the world's population, and they've determined that these two sets of languages have a common origin. There's a fellow named Blažek in Czechoslovakia who is now traced back for four other language groups in the world, as well as these two, a proto-world root for 12 words already. And this is done systematically by a rigorous method, so there's not much chance of an error. And we are tracing back to Genesis 11:1, therefore, when the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. It continues, "Come, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth." And it does appear to be from this region that they were scattered. Now, just a little bit of an aside. From what we see of the spread and divergence of languages, it would appear one language is different. The Sumerian or Old Babylonian languages cannot be classified as either the Western group, including ours, or the Eastern group of Chinese languages. It defies classification. It would seem to suggest that the way in which Genesis 11 was brought about was that the Sumerians concocted an underworld language so that they could communicate their dirty works with one another without letting other people know what they were up to. There's our first language of the mob. We come to biblical archaeology. Remarkably, biblical archaeology was not started by scholars trying to see what the Bible was saying, but rather by people trying to disprove the Bible by showing that these places never existed and these events never took place. Well, something went wrong along the path, and they discovered the places they didn't want and the events that they didn't wish. Enough so that we now can go back to Genesis chapter 14. In the beginning it says that Ur-Nammu, king of Sumer, and several others came from the east, four kings total, and they beat up on the kings of the west and put them to tribute for 12 years. And in the 13th year they rebelled, and in the 14th year they come back to put down the rebellion, which they do, but they make one mistake, they take Lot captive. Now Abram must go to defend them. Otherwise he would have cared little for the outcome, I suppose. But having taken his nephew captive, he is duty-bound to go after him. So his allies and he go together, and they beat up on the kings of the east. They wait till they're having their drunken celebration at night, and then they go in and slaughter the bunch of them. What we need then is a king from the east who beats up the west some year, and 14 years later he dies in battle. And we have just such a king, Ur-Nammu, king of Sumer. According to what, let's see, they give five different chronologies, some of which are plausible and others which are not. I'll use what they call the low chronology now. this Ur-Nammu, king of Sumer, claims a victory in his fourth year, and he dies in battle in his 18th year. There's our 14 years. He is also the last king of the East to reign over the kings in the West, perhaps for 1,000 years. So Abraham has done his job and done it very well. It's no wonder he is so well thought of among other nations, including the Arabs. Consistent with that chronology, we come down to the time of Joseph. And Joseph comes to power, it would appear, by comparing the chronology of Egypt for the so-called 12th dynasty or Middle Kingdom with that of the second volume chronology. Joseph comes to power in the fourth year of Amenemhes the Third, and how are you going to remember that? Well, just don't worry about it. But he does a number of interesting things we now learn from the archaeology. The first thing he does is to shut down the stone quarries. You got something more important to do than just building monuments. And very shortly, 90 square kilometers of new farmland is opened up in the Fayum district. Well, that's logical. You're going to have 7 years of famine coming up, so during the 7 years of plenty, open up all the farmland you can. We could go in more detail. Well, I think I'll settle for one more. The regional rulers, or nomarchs, have elaborate and expensive tombs in the early part of this king's reign. He reigned about 43 years. And then in the later part of his reign, they are wretchedly poor. And the third thing that the archaeologists do not claim to understand is what happened here, because there's no sign of a revolution. Again, through the scriptures, we can understand full well what happened. During the 7 years of plenty, the Pharaoh was keeping up the farm prices by buying the excess from the farmers, and the regional rulers were living very high off the hog. Well, personally, I prefer cattle, so let's say high off the cow. But then during the 7 years of plenty, the nomarchs and everybody else had to sell everything they had and finally even sell themselves to Pharaoh, until they were therefore wretchedly poor. Another mystery of archaeology, they call the district of the Fayum Enoch Amenemhet, life from Amenemhes. And this is unusual because the Egyptians commemorate death more than life. But we can understand it, because in the reign of Amenemhes III, Egypt was spared from starvation. Canaan was caused to survive. The world of that region was saved by the wise policies of this Pharaoh under his second in command, Joseph. This Pharaoh began in war, but it didn't last long. Most of his reign was a reign of peace. His fame was spread far and wide. His statues are found even in central Lebanon, Byblos. Why? He saved the world, and the world was grateful to him. Other great pharaohs had to do it by war. This one did it in peace. We can go on from there. Moses, and I will suggest, though there is a brother with another thought on this, that we have Yannis and Yambres, who withstood Moses to the face. And here I think we're talking of the pharaohs of the Hyksos dynasty, that Yannis is well attested as the greatest of the Hyksos kings. He died somewhere around 1620. Now, we don't know the Hyksos dates that well, because in subsequent generations they were terribly hated. What will you expect in this country if it goes bankrupt? What do people say about the president? They said worse than that about the Pharaoh of the Exodus and in his dynasty. And Yambres would appear to be the Pharaoh of the Exodus. We go on from there. We could talk about Joshua at Jericho. there was a massive desolation at the end of what they call the Middle Bronze Age. That's about the middle of the 1500s B.C., 1580, 1575, maybe 1530. Who caused that except the invading Israelites? Jericho was massively destroyed by fire. Why? Scriptures say Jericho was burned by Joshua. A curse was placed on he who would rebuild it. We must go on, so we will omit Deborah and Barak and Gideon and the Elamarna letters warning about the Habaru threatening Jerusalem, or the Philistine captivity and so forth. And we'll go on to now the last of these, papyrology. In the past century, nearly 100 papyruses of the New Testament have been discovered. Most of them quite fragmentary, but some of them have several leaves, several pages. The largest collection of Bible papyri in the Western Hemisphere is right here in this state. It is at Ann Arbor, the University Library, and I think a fellow back in the Los Angeles area describes it as the best-kept secret in the United States. But it is about the fourth or fifth best collection in the entire world. These manuscripts help to confirm that the New Testament, as we have it, is largely accurate. It doesn't have the interest for scholars that the classical writings do, because there aren't so many variations as we see in the writings of Homer or Virgil or whoever. And with the Dead Sea Scrolls, it gets even more boring for the scholar, because there are still fewer variations. I think that is an encouragement to the Bible student. We understand that the book that we have has a good, solid foundation and has had relatively little tampering. None? No, we can't claim that. But we do have a fairly complete evidence collection now, still more being discovered continually, but we now have 3,200 Greek New Testament manuscripts. Of these, at least 22 are of really top value. There's one papyrus in Manchester, England, the John Rylands Library, dating to about A.D. 125. That's the current best date. Could be 130, but somewhere around there. It makes the higher critics of the past century look a little foolish when they said that the Gospel of John couldn't possibly have been written before the end of the second century, and more probably third century. This manuscript, fragment in John the 18th chapter, was written over a century before they thought. It contains, appropriately enough, Pilate's famous question, "What is truth?" Now, among the things that have been changed, in Acts 8:37, we can see from early manuscripts that the baptismal formula was added. One of the more notable corrections was pointed out by no less than Isaac Newton himself. That's in 1 Timothy 3:16, where he who was manifested in the flesh was changed by a single stroke of the pen to God manifested in the flesh. Could have been done carelessly, or it could have been done wittingly. That we don't know, and it is not our privilege to ascribe motives to other people. But in one case, we do have evidence of it. Oh, are you here already? In 1 John 5, 7 and 8, the Trinitarian formula was not found in the early Greek or later Greek. It was not found in the early Latin, but it was added during the time of the Trinitarian controversy. Being not in the Greek, Erasmus didn't put it in his Greek New Testament, for which he received considerable flack, until he finally agreed, "You show me one Greek manuscript that's got it, and I'll put it in my next edition." Well, the ink was hardly dry when they brought it to him. Here we have a case of a deliberate change. But most of them appear to be either accidental or small, like "he saith" is changed to "he saith unto them." Still, there's a couple of other places where corrections are probably required, like 1 Corinthians 15:51 and 2. It's either, the better manuscript seemed to me to say, "We shall all sleep, but we shall not all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye," a changing of the word "not." In Revelation 20, verse 5, the first sentence is not omitted just by the Sinaitic manuscript, but 68 Greek manuscripts omit it out of approximately 200. We can go on in further detail. The Syriac, for example, never contained it. The two best out of three manuscripts both omit it. So it is altogether probable that the expression "the rest of the dead lived not until the 1,000 years were finished" was not added until the 5th century. Now, there's one more thing beyond these areas of study, science, and that is if we recognize that the scriptures are well-founded, they remain accurate today, science is confirming it, sometimes by intent and sometimes with greatest reluctance, we still need to do something about it. After all, I suspect this is part of the rejection of the scriptures by so many scientists, even when their science points towards the scriptures, that if there is a God, then we do have a responsibility to the Creator. Plus the fact that in some of the areas, like paleobiology and paleogenetics, they want to keep their jobs. Otherwise, they may lose not only their jobs, but their careers. Well, I feel sorry for them for that, but I'm not in a position so I can say anything I want. Now, we can draw certain lessons from the things which are confirmed in archaeology. Let's take Abraham, and we have maybe time for Joseph, too. According to the record, Abraham was ready to offer up his only son, his firstborn. And the Lord, of course, provided a substitute. But why was this recorded unless he was showing us ahead the time would come when God would sacrifice his own son? As a result of this, a promise was given, a ray of hope, not for ourselves only, but for the whole human race. "In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." Only four times in the scriptures does the Lord God swear. This is one, the promise to Abraham. "In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." We come down to the time of Joseph, and we see that he, with his Pharaoh, saved Joseph's family, but more than his family. The Egyptians, Canaan, and all the world round about. Was he doing less than show that God's only son would join with him to bless all the families of the earth? He is the savior of his brethren. He is the savior of the whole world, and especially of his brethren, of the church. We don't have time to go on further, except that if ye know these things, blessed are ye, if. One more. What's that? That's right. If ye know these things, blessed are ye if ye do them. So we can appreciate that God has given us his word and confirmed it, and now we need to act upon it, to do what we can to attune our hearts to where it is our desire to participate with him in blessing all the families of the earth, and that in his kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Jim, for giving us our update on the science and the Bible controversy which has been raging. And no, Brother Jim, not many of us read the paleogenetic journal, so thank you for doing it.
Our dear Heavenly Father, hallowed be thy wonderful and most holy name. We thank thee for the privilege of looking into thy word, would ask for guidance in helping us to tune our minds and hearts, our thoughts and our ways to thee. We look forward to thy kingdom. May it soon begin. We look forward to the hope of the resurrection of the dead, the bringing all back to perfection as thou performest thy word, and help us to tune ourselves in that path. We ask in Jesus' precious and most worthy name. Amen.